In the city of Utrecht, in the middle of the Netherlands, there is a narrow, quiet street called Parkstraat. It's lined by dense clusters of bicycles, as most streets in the Netherlands are. The solid, high walls of the conjoined brick facades create a confusion about where one address ends and the next begins. In the first week of August, 1992, the owner of an empty house at No. 3 Parkstraat, near the top of the street, made a call to the local police. He said that he had intended to sell the property and, while inspecting its condition, found something concerning in the basement. There were a few guns from World War II in boxes stored there, and he was concerned that there might be quite a lot more, because the house had been the headquarters of the security service of the occupying German army. Not wanting to blow himself up, he thought that the police could conduct an investigation and be blown up instead. The Utrecht police arrived with the department's metal detector and started to survey the basement floor. There was definitely metal buried there, and so they began to dig, very cautiously. By the afternoon, they had unearthed several packages that were seeping chemicals and had formed crystals, like batteries left in a flashlight too long. This was a bad sign. Experience with World War II-era weapons and bombs buried all over the Netherlands, and buried all over Europe generally, had shown that chemical crystals were an indication of instability. The Utrecht police, not wanting to be blown up, called the Explosive Cleaning Service, the bomb squad, to be blown up instead. The bomb squad arrived on Parkstraat along with the fire department, ambulances, and the national, regional, and local Dutch media, all competing for interviews with people involved, or just people who had been ejected from their homes on the street in case the explosive cleaning service exploded. There were a few tense hours, but in the end, all was well. The next day, news around the country announced the discovery of excavated weapons, ammunition, and radio equipment from the Second World War. In the basement of No. 3 Parkstraat, the explosive cleaning service found and then removed 6 FN Browning high-powered pistols, a box with 10 hand grenades, ammunition, pipe bombs, and 2 complete radio transmitters. There was also a Welrod pistol, important for this treasure hunt. A Welrod was manufactured by the British in World War II and was equipped with an extremely effective suppressor. It was used by resistance organizations for assassinations. The box of hand grenades found in the basement was also manufactured by the British. So, what were the Germans doing with all of this British contraband? A little research by some interested parties in 1992 turned up a twist that historical researchers are always coming across, and that is just that sometimes that matter-of-fact and truthful story received over time from your grandfather, God bless him, is just wrong. It turns out that the German SD, the security service, didn't occupy No. 3 Parkstraat. They occupied No. 2, across the street. That meant, obviously, that No. 3 was a secret hideout and weapons cache for the Dutch resistance during the war. How brazen to put it right across the street from the Germans. From that discovery on, the police and the national media ran with that narrative. The weapons cache in Utrecht was put there by World War II resistance fighters. But there was a problem in the timeline that was discovered by an amateur radio enthusiast and a writer named Wim Kramer, who was given a chance to look at the radio equipment while it was at the Utrecht police station. He recognized a problem with the public story immediately. The radios were post-war Philips radios. They couldn't have been part of the wartime resistance. They were too new. After some digging, the truth about the Parkstraat cache became clear. It was the property of the O&I, Operations and Intelligence, the Dutch Cold War stay-behind organization that stood ready to resist a Soviet invasion for more than 40 years. It was one of many networks in nearly every country in Europe, organized under NATO, funded and trained by MI6 and the CIA, and manned by civilian sleeper agents. Operation Gladio, the European stay-behind networks. This time on the Cold War Vault. While the last episode focused on the stay-behind agents of Alaska, there are really so many more stories to tell about civilian and military organizations during the Cold War that made plans for the worst cases. The second worst case being a conventional invasion and occupation by an enemy force, and the first worst being a complete collapse of deterrence and a massive nuclear war. And it's true that in the United States and elsewhere, some volunteered to be designated stay-behind agents in nuclear war zones, tasked with reporting on radiation levels and the extent of damage and death in ruined cities, probably at the cost of their own lives. It's the dedication that strikes me, the selflessness of these characters, and let's be honest, the chance for some payback in the face of another 20th century war. Many of the seeds of the stay-behind programs in Europe emerged during World War II in the form of resistance cells throughout Nazi-occupied territory. But it was clear to the intelligence community that the techniques used by the resistance against the German forces would be insufficient in the face of the new threat. The former director of the CIA, William Colby, summed up the fundamental difference this way. He wrote, "The model that we had used in the European resistance against the Nazis cannot be appropriate in the face of the totalitarian threat that seeks to enlist and not only to subjugate the populations it occupied." Meaning that the potential threat would be ideological as well as military, and the job of a resistance movement would necessarily have to maintain the hearts and minds of the occupied population, as well as undermine the occupying force. This would be no small task. In February 1948, the government of Czechoslovakia fell in a communist coup. It would begin 40 years of communist control. The event was a shock to the newly established CIA, and it began an aggressive campaign to counter the threat. Hardly more than 2 months into the CIA's efforts, the Soviet Union created an international crisis by blockading Berlin. Of course, this is the beginning of the storied Berlin airlift, but that's for another day. This demonstrated the strong motivation of the Soviets to push boundaries and test international norms, but it also offered a real wake-up call for the CIA. If Berlin fell and suddenly found itself 100 miles deep in Soviet-held territory, as it would have, then wouldn't it have been nice to have a stay-behind network in the city? On June 18, 1948, in the midst of the Berlin crisis and facing the reality of the clearly expansionist Soviet Union, the National Security Council created the Office of Special Projects with Directive NSC 10-2. The directive stated, in fairly bold language, quote, in the interest of world peace and U.S. national security, the overt foreign activities of the U.S. government must be supplemented by covert operations. The directive placed the job under the CIA and made that job very clear. Point 5 specified that covert operations are understood to be activities planned and executed so that any U.S. government responsibility for them is not evident to unauthorized persons, and that if uncovered, the U.S. can plausibly disclaim any responsibility. This is the definition of covert in the world of intelligence. The sponsor of the action is hidden. It's sometimes confused with clandestine, which means that something is carried out so that it isn't noticed at all, in case you were wondering. And even if you weren't. The covert, and sometimes clandestine, operations suggested in the NSA directive included, but certainly weren't limited to, propaganda, economic warfare, preventive direct action including sabotage, anti-sabotage, demolition, and evacuation measures, subversion against hostile states, including assistance to underground resistance movements, keep that one in mind, of course, guerrillas and refugee liberation groups, and support of indigenous anti-communist elements in threatened countries of the free world. With the legal or quasi-legal nod given to the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA went about finding and funding every anti-communist group it could find. It turned out that in the wake of World War II, and with the looming Red Menace, there were quite a few. The early years are murky. The networks were often loose and anonymous, with members refusing to speak on the matter during their lives, even years after the public acknowledgement of the various national programs. There were no archival records kept, and no legal basis for maintaining permanent files, and so later hearings in several countries regarding the stay-behind networks revealed the complete destruction of records after the end of the program. In France, some of the structure of the World War II resistance was reconstituted to form a preemptive resistance network in the case of a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. That was as early as 1946 or 47. Planning for a joint Anglo-Belgian security strategy, including stay-behind programs, began in 1949. And may have resulted in the formation of agent networks as early as 1951 or 52. Again, these years vary depending on the source because of the necessarily disconnected nature of the nodes of the network, which was, of course, by design. In the later years after the revelation of the programs, even interviews and depositions of former agents resulted in differing histories. Kampfgruppe gegen Unmenschlichkeit, or Combat Group Against Inhumanity, was founded in West Berlin in 1948. We know that to be true because their antics were well documented by the U.S. government and their financial backers, which included the government of West Germany, the CIA, and the Ford Foundation. A few of those antics I mentioned included, among sabotage and arson, Operation Easter Bunny, when the group forged 150,000 letters from the East German government to East German shops, announcing government-mandated price cuts in order to cause runs on particularly scarce commodities. Oh, you devils. With each country proceeding to develop anti-communist forces in their own ways and for their own specific national ends, dates begin to resolve themselves when the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, began to bring each under its wing. Though NATO had been constituted in April 1949, it really took the Korean War to bring it out of bureaucratic morass and make it a practical, functional alliance. And so it was through the 1950s that the various national stay-behind programs began to take shape as pieces of a larger network. That would come to be called Operation Gladio. I want to correct the record here. It wasn't really called Operation Gladio. Gladio was just the Italian stay-behind operation. The collective group of national stay-behind programs came to be called Gladio in the press because the revelation of the network happened almost first in Italy in 1990, and certainly most dramatically. Throughout this story, I'll refer to the revelations of 1990. This was a chain reaction, beginning in Italy, in which national bodies throughout Western Europe began to ask, often indignantly, if they too had supported a secret armed network funded and trained by the CIA. The answer was usually a qualified yes. What is still popularly today referred to as Operation Gladio comprised the programs of 15 European countries and the United States. Each organization, though they were interconnected, had their own operational names and, for better or worse, historical legacies. It's difficult to find a straightforward narrative thread for approaching each of the national programs of Operation Gladio. One didn't beget another, though they often used the same organizational structure. Each was born of its own national experience, and particularly its wartime experience. As many of them emerged before the CIA and NATO came to fund and support them, there's no solid chronological order to follow, but I can tell you about a few of the programs that would come to comprise the wider NATO stay-behind network. Any one of them could have its own large body of scholarship. Some do. So this is just a sampling of the giant octopus that came to be known as Operation Gladio. This episode began with a story about the Netherlands. We'll start there. The Dutch stay-behind program, under the name O&I for Operatien en Inlichtingen, or Operations and Intelligence, was a network built around organizers and operators. Each organizer was assigned an operator, who would in turn keep the organizer in touch with the government in exile through expertise in ciphering and radio equipment. The organizer would develop a clandestine network in the event of invasion. In all, there were between 100 and 200 agents in the Dutch network at any one time. The network's staff had about 20 people who would evacuate in the event of an invasion and maintain control of the agents in the field from exile. When the existence of the O&I network was revealed in 1990, the Dutch Prime Minister told the press over and over that the national program was autonomous and not under the control of NATO, MI6, or the CIA. This was technically true, though only technically. That kind of subjugation would have been generally bad for the national image. Not being under the control of those organizations did not mean that O&I was on its own. It maintained strong relationships with similar programs in the UK, France, Belgium, and Luxembourg. Along with the Netherlands, Belgium and Luxembourg are collectively known as Benelux. And this union proved particularly important in aligning the stay-behind organizations of those three countries. Belgium originally pushed to exclude the United States, and by extension the CIA, from the organization entirely. This was a point of national image and pride. And when the networks were revealed in 1990, Just like in the Netherlands, governments went out of their way to downplay the role of the CIA in organizing, training, and funding the groups. Nevertheless, as documents in the U.S. archives have been slowly declassified in the decades since the end of the Cold War, it has become fairly clear that the CIA had a significant role in organizing and training stay-behind networks throughout Western Europe, including Belgium, whether they liked it or not. Despite those later claims that each national program was essentially independent, in 1949, with the threat of Soviet aggression clear and the divide between East and West becoming all the wider, the need for alliances for security and defense became obvious. Belgium, along with the Netherlands and Luxembourg, joined France and Great Britain in the Comité Clandestin de l'Union Occidentale, pardon my French, or the Clandestine Committee of the Western Union. The CCUO coordinated the stay-behind networks and laid the groundwork for cooperation in the years to come. The Nordic countries represented another case, unique in its difficulties. Even though Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and Finland were historically and geographically linked, they found themselves at the end of World War II with very different geopolitical positions. Their participation in the NATO stay-behind network, or lack thereof, reflected that. Former director of the CIA, William Colby, explained the sometimes confounding mix in his memoir. He wrote that the situation in each of the Nordic countries was different, that Norway and Denmark were NATO allies, and so their participation fell into the category of the relatively normal and expected. But Sweden was neutral, and as a national policy, that neutrality had served it well in two world wars. Finland, on the other hand, had escaped the fate of other states on the Soviet border and maintained its independence, but it came at the cost of abundant caution in matters of foreign policy. Finland was very careful not to poke the Soviet bear. The nations that chose to build their own networks had to coordinate the stay-behind network with NATO's plans and consider technical aspects, like procuring specialized radio equipment from the CIA to be put into their caches. In countries eagerly trying to avoid the appearance of allying with NATO, like Sweden and Finland, the CIA itself carried out the development of the agent network, sometimes with unofficial local help, though sometimes not. The maintenance of the appearance of total neutrality was paramount in those countries. As William Colby wrote, it was in the hope that neutrality or non-alignment would allow them to slip through a World War III unharmed. A notable CIA intervention during the development of the stay-behind networks took place in Greece. It was one of those unsavory CIA manipulations that came about from a policy born of the adage, "The enemy of my enemy is my friend." The stay-behind operation in Greece was born entirely out of the Second World War. The National Liberation Front had been a powerful anti-Axis resistance force during the war, but they were also a communist force, and this made them unacceptable to the West in the New World Order. In April 1944, the National Liberation Front supported an uprising among the Greek forces in Egypt. The uprising was suppressed, but it was an undeniable wake-up call to the Greek government in exile. As a reaction to the communist uprising, the government formed the 3rd Greek Mountain Brigade, and filled its ranks with staunchly right-wing and therefore reliable men. Even those with only moderately conservative views were considered to be too left-leaning and were excluded. When Greece joined NATO in 1952, the companies of that extreme right-wing brigade were integrated into the stay-behind network of Greece and the larger European program. The CIA took a major role in outfitting and training the mountain raiding parties, known as LOK in Greek. This group was tasked with the usual preparations for living and working under a Soviet occupation that were common to the other stay-behind organizations. But the CIA had some additional requests. The LOK was also instructed to prevent the political rise of any leftist group in Greece through whatever means necessary. And so they did. To that end, the LOK was involved in the right-wing military coup of April 21, 1967, that established a military junta, known as the regime of the colonels, that lasted until 1974. Despite the claims of many of the Operation Gladio countries to have been independent, a claim that is less likely as the years go on and the documents come out, there were countries with stay-behind networks that were special cases, either only loosely affiliated with NATO or not at all, or run without governmental knowledge by the CIA. These were Sweden, Finland, Austria, Switzerland, and Spain. Spain is an interesting case with a murky history when it comes to Gladio. During the 1990 revelations, Spanish authorities, including the Spanish president and the Minister of Defense, strongly denied that a stay-behind network under NATO had ever operated in Spain. Their reasoning being that if it had, they would have definitely heard about it, and that Spanish dictator Francisco Franco, who was in power until his death in 1975, was such a feverish anti-communist that the network wouldn't have been necessary. Franco was the best line of defense against leftist forces that the CIA could hope for. Nevertheless, testimony from an Italian Gladio agent revealed that there had been at least one meeting and agent training held in Spain's Canary Islands. Some investigative journalism also found that Gladio had used former NASA facilities on Gran Canaria in the 1970s. This would have been the Maspalomas installation that was decommissioned from 1975 to 1979. What they were doing with the giant tracking dish is anyone's guess. But for you armchair history sleuths, today, in 2019, Maspalomas Station is mysteriously blurred out in Google's satellite imagery. So start your investigations now. Did Gladio operate in Spain? It's very likely. It's also very possible that it was quietly dismantled when Franco's regime ended, leaving the successor government entirely in the dark. Sweden and Finland, as mentioned earlier in William Colby's memoir, were non-aligned Nordic countries where the CIA operated to construct stay-behind networks independent of the government's knowledge. At least without the appearance of the government's knowledge. After 1990, some Swedish agents came forward to tell their stories. One of them, Reinhold Geier, felt that the government denial was ridiculous, remembering that all prospective agents were checked through the domestic security police. His recollection of training clearly describes British government involvement, at least. He said, "In 1959, I went via London to a farm outside of Eton. This was done under the strictest secrecy procedures. with, for instance, a forged passport. I was not even allowed to call my wife. The aim of the training was to learn how to use dead letter box techniques to receive and send secret messages, and other James Bond-style exercises. The British were very tough. I sometimes had the feeling that we were overdoing it. Paul Garbler, a CIA agent operating in Sweden during the 1990 revelations, said that Sweden was a direct participant in the network, and that, quote, "I'm not able to talk about it without causing the Swedes a good deal of heartburn." Throughout the Cold War, Finland was paralyzed by its proximity to and agreements with the Soviet Union. In 1950, the CIA and MI6 agreed that any operations carried out on the territory had to be completely hidden. The CIA secretly approached Americans in Finland, who in turn suggested Finnish citizens who might be contacted. The CIA station chief in Helsinki from 1970 to 1976 confirmed that the secret Finnish army was funded, equipped, and trained by the CIA, and that the agency felt the network was a major success, having developed entirely in secret a solid force against the Soviets in the event of an invasion and a meaningful deterrent to the rise of internal leftist political parties. The compartmentalization of information about the stay-behind network in Finland was so successful that after the 1990 revelations, the Finnish defense minister, Elisabeth Rehn, referred to the secret stay-behind force as a fairy tale. Or, she added, "at least an incredible story of which I know nothing." The Austrian stay-behind program was constituted in 1951 with significant assistance from the CIA and a blind eye from the US, British, and French occupation authorities. Needless to say, the Soviets were unaware of the network. It isn't exactly right to describe the group as a stay-behind organization yet in 1951, as its real purpose was to prevent a communist coup in Austria. Really, they were more of a secret army, hidden by the name the Austrian Association of Hiking, Sports, and Society, an innocent social club, whose weapons came from the post-war surpluses of other armies and vehicles were bought in the club's name. In the U.S. occupation zone, a large patch of land was purchased as a mountain training camp. Though the occupying forces withdrew in 1955, the CIA maintained a constant support of the group, which was brought loosely into the NATO network of stay-behinds. But the continued existence of the Austrian Association was ensured when the Hungarian invasion of 1956 by the Soviet Union sent 200,000 refugees into Austria. Some of these, the CIA reasoned, would certainly be communist infiltrators, and so the presence of an anti-communist organization was still necessary. In 1990, the Austrian government claimed that no secret army had existed in the country, fearing damage to their reputation as a neutral power. But 6 years later, investigations by the Boston Globe uncovered the existence of CIA arms caches in Austria. The president and chancellor of Austria demanded a complete investigation by the United States into violations of Austria's neutrality. President Bill Clinton politely declined the demand. The administration's response was uncharacteristically straightforward for matters of international indignation like these. A spokesman for the U.S. State Department named Nicholas Burns was sent to lay out the official line on the matter. Here's what he said. "The aim was noble. The aim was correct. To try to help Austria if it was under occupation. what went wrong is that successive Washington administrations simply decided not to talk to the Austrian government about it. Though several years late to the parade of revelations brought about by Italy in 1990, Burns confirmed that there were similar networks with similar arms caches hidden throughout Western Europe. He declined to name them all, he said, for fear of forgetting some countries. In Switzerland, the planned stay-behind operation was known as Project 26. It began within the territorial service of the Swiss Army, but was moved eventually to the Military Intelligence Agency. The structure of the network followed a similar format. The top level consisted of members of the regular Swiss military. The next level was comprised of loyal civilians who would recruit their own intelligence network. It is notable that Switzerland was one of only three countries in the wake of the revelations to launch a parliamentary investigation, the others being Belgium and Italy. Though some of the networks had been disbanded by the end of the Cold War, their existence and the larger NATO program remained mostly secret. That is, until the revelations. Here's how that happened. In October 1990, the Italian Prime Minister, Giulio Andreotti, made the existence of the Italian branch of the NATO Stay Behind program official with a speech to the Italian Senate. The floodgates opened, and within days, officials in almost every other NATO country described similar operations. The Prime Minister admitted that the Italian government had hidden weapons caches throughout the country during the 1950s and 60s, and it seems very likely that those caches were maintained. When the Prime Minister made his speech, Operation Gladio still had 600 people on the official payroll. In the speech, he recommended dismantling the network, given, in his words, the new climate which has freed us from the nightmare of wars and divisions. Perhaps a little short-sighted. This new feeling of post-Soviet brotherly love was, of course, just a cover. Andreotti was really forced to make the announcement after an investigation into a 1972 car bombing revealed that the explosives came from the Operation Gladio stock. As a side note, though often suspected, it was never proven that the Gladio operatives, much less the CIA, had any direct involvement in the extensive political violence in those years, known as the Years of Lead. The Monday after the Italian revelation, France confirmed its own long-standing cooperation with NATO and Gladio. The French president dissolved the organization just before the announcement was made. The flood of admissions and dissolutions of the stay-behind networks came quickly. The announcements often came from former officials, so as to soften the blow on incumbents. In Belgium, a former intelligence official revealed the existence of multiple arms caches. The former Dutch defense minister told the Associated Press that weapons caches for sabotage had been hidden throughout the Netherlands. Greece was quick to remind the newly interested world that it had dismantled its anti-communist network in the mid-1980s and disposed of its caches. By the end of the first week, Luxembourg and the newly reunited Germany declared their involvement in the program as well. It is probably right to say that these decades-old networks were dismantled without fanfare. In most cases, there's no evidence that there was a final payment or any concerted effort to reclaim much of the equipment left in the hands of former agents or in their basements. But even with the rapid-fire pace of geopolitical events in 1990 and 91, which rendered the stay-behind networks seemingly unnecessary, and the political push to see their dissolution, the Prime Minister of Luxembourg did take the time to write a letter that, I think, is heartfelt, largely because it was entirely unnecessary. It was sent in the blind, and I've translated it this way. To all members of the Stay Behind Network, at the moment, on my instructions, the State Intelligence Service has just completed the dissolution of the Stay Behind Network, of which you were a part. It is my pleasure to thank you for your commitment. Your patriotic feelings have led you to accept, for years, an ungrateful mission to which you have given your time without feeling entitled to or asking for the least compensation. A note here, unlike most of the other operations, the Luxembourg network was only compensated for travel costs to and from training. They were never paid. The Prime Minister continues, "You have rendered a great service to the country. You are firmly anchored in the social body. You have hoped for the maintenance of peace while preparing for a cruel eventuality that you abhor as much as any other Luxembourger. You agreed to act on the lessons of the events of 1940 to 1945 that the resistance had to learn at their expense and for which they had to pay a terrible price. Whatever some say, misinformed or mischievous, I tell you now that you have taken on an important mission and that you have helped to maintain the credibility of our homeland with respect to its allies. The dissolution of the Stay Behind Network has to happen for reasons that have nothing to do with the organization and the functioning of the network, which, I note with satisfaction, was never outside of the legal framework. I apologize for addressing you in this anonymous form, but I am persuaded that you will understand that I do not want your identities to appear in any official document, although this document has allowed me to show my great respect for you. With what will undoubtedly be the last contact this government has with you as an agent of the Stay Behind Network, and with my personal thanks, I offer you, Madam or Sir, my distinguished consideration. Signed, the Prime Minister." There is one more story that I think is important to share. That is about the Stay Behind Network that was developed in Turkey. It came about, like the others, during the early 1950s. Turkey joined the Atlantic Alliance in 1952, despite not being anywhere near the Atlantic, but that's another story. The Stay Behind Network was already operating under the codename Counter Guerrilla, or Contra Guerrilla. Along with other NATO countries, the government of Turkey admitted to operating the secret network in 1990. The former prime minister of Turkey at the time, and leader of the left-leaning opposition, Bülent Ecevit, said that he had first learned about the program in 1974, and added in his remarks to the press that he thought the network might have been involved in domestic terrorism, specifically the Taksim Square massacre on the 1st of May 1977, when snipers fired on a massive crowd celebrating May Day. The acting defense minister suggested that Ecevit should keep his mouth shut. A former Turkish military officer and noted leftist activist and author, Talat Turhan, was tortured by the counter-guerrilla group in 1972 in the notorious Zeverbi Villa in Istanbul. The house was used as an interrogation and torture center after the 1971 coup. He wrote of the incident this way. "In the torture villa, the torture team of retired officer Ayup Ozalkus, chief of the Turkish Intelligence Services interrogation team for the combat of communism, blindfolded me and tied up my arms and feet. Then they told me that I was now in the hands of a counter-guerrilla unit operating under the high command of the army outside the Constitution and the laws. They told me that they considered me as their prisoner of war and that I was sentenced to death. Talat Turhan escaped the punishment after 2 years in prison, fighting charges of domestic terrorism. The Turkish parliament formed a committee in 1993, in the wake of the larger revelations of stay-behind groups, to investigate allegations that the counter-guerrilla force had carried out various murders and assassinations. The committee listed 1,797 mysterious deaths that might be attributed to the counter-guerrilla force, with 316 in 1992 and 314 in 1993 alone. The head of military intelligence, and therefore the commander of the counter-guerrilla network, made a call to the Speaker of the Parliament, asking that the investigation be stopped because it would eventually expose the identities of his agents. At the same time, the State Security Court prosecutor ordered the Turkish police force not to cooperate with the committee's investigation, essentially ending the inquiry. The activities of Turkey's counter-guerrilla group are still classified in U.S. and European defense and intelligence circles. Counter-guerrilla is also unique in the wider NATO network, as it was never dismantled. The anti-left activities of the group continue, unchecked by the elected government, to this day. What we can learn from the stay-behind programs in Europe, those that fell officially or unofficially into what would be called Operation Gladio, is that the extraordinary threats of the Cold War resulted in extraordinary actions from what were most often ordinary citizens. Were they short-sighted in outing the networks and shutting the programs down at the moment the Cold War seemed to be over? Maybe. Or maybe the CIA learned some valuable lessons from those 40 years of stay-behind operations and buried their networks just a little deeper. It makes you wonder if your neighbor or your coworker or even your husband or wife has a secret they're keeping or a weapons cache in the basement, waiting for a very dark day indeed. Thank you so much for stopping by The Vault. This episode was researched, written, and produced by DJ Kinney. That's me. For show notes or information on the music you've heard on this show, go to coldwarvault.com. Like and subscribe on Facebook and Twitter at Cold War Vault, and like the show anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. Keep your cache secret and carry on. Until next time.